The headlines: Canada says it has been investigating abuse allegations at a former Indigenous school since 2011 with anger over the discovery of unmarked graves in several such schools. Officers giving a testimony during a congressional inquiry into the U.S. Capitol protest in January say they were beaten and taunted with racial insults. The International Monetary Fund warns of widening gaps between rich and poor countries due to unequal distribution of COVID-19 vaccines. Hello and welcome, everybody. It's our top story for this half hour. Canadian police have revealed that they've been investigating abuse allegations at a former residential school for Indigenous children since 2011. The revelation follows an inquiry by a local media outlet in Manitoba province about the government-funded Fort Alexander School. Police say they have talked to more than 700 people in their search for potential victims. So far, no criminal charges have been filed. Fort Alexander was closed in 1970. It was one of dozens of boarding schools founded to forcibly integrate thousands of Indigenous children over the past century. Many children suffered ill treatment and systematic abuse at the church-run institutions. The issue has drawn fresh attention in recent months after the discovery of more than 1,300 unmarked graves in several residential schools. International lawyer Barry Grossman says Canada's federal government needs to take serious action over the claims of abuse and Indigenous children.
It strikes me that they haven't dedicated the resources or the sense of urgency to this investigation that it calls for. It's getting out of hand. More and more burial sites are being discovered, unmarked graves are being discovered, and people want answers. And the Prime Minister certainly said he was committed to implementing the recommendations of a previous inquiry, but certainly a number of those recommendations and the people that needed to be funded are now saying that they're not in funds. They haven't received anything near the support that's required from the Canadian federal government. The people of Canada, the victims, the families of victims and their tribal relations all want answers. And to be sure, I mean, there's issues of money involved in all this, with the federal government obviously wanting to avoid unnecessary and inappropriate payouts. But ultimately, everything hangs on proper investigations. And from what I can see, the federal government has been paying lip service to this matter for far too long, and it's time for some action.
A congressional inquiry into the U.S. Capitol protests on January the 6th has kicked off with testimonies from police officers who faced off a group of then-President Donald Trump supporters. The hearing panel was convened with four police officers, two from Capitol Police and two from Washington, D.C. Metropolitan Police Department. The officers told the lawmakers they were beaten, taunted with racial insults, and were even threatened to death by the protesters. The officers called them terrorists engaged in an attempted coup. They also criticized the lawmakers who have sought to downplay the incident. The officers urged the investigation committee to determine what happened on that day.
I use an analogy to describe what I want as a hitman. If a hitman is hired and he kills somebody, the hitman goes to jail. But not only does the hitman go to jail, but the person who hired them does. There was an attack carried out on January 6th, and a hitman sent them. I want you to get to the bottom of that.
The lawmakers on the panel hailed the officers for risking their lives in defending the Capitol building. They pledged to find the truth and ensure accountability. The White House also responded to the testimonies, saying they were, quote, a searing reminder of the shameful events of January the 6th. Trump supporters stormed the Capitol on that day, trying to stop the certification of the presidential election, which Donald Trump lost to Joe Biden. Four people died during or shortly after the incident, and dozens of police were wounded. Two American police officers have been arrested following the beating of an unarmed African-American man in the state of Colorado. The following footage from the officer's body cam contains graphic content and may be upsetting to some people.
Get on your face now, okay?
Bro,
on your face! Okay, bro. Okay.
Get on your face.
On your face.
Killing me, bro.
On your face.
Killing me.
Get on your face, bitch.
On the footage released by the Aurora Police Department, the victim repeatedly cries, "Don't shoot me," and "Help." A male officer is seen pistol whipping and choking the man. The officer is charged with attempted first-degree assault, second-degree assault, oppression, felony menacing, and first-degree official misconduct. Also, a second officer is accused of failing to intervene and report the use of force by his colleague. Aurora police officials have called the arrest a very despicable act. Cities across the United States have been the scene of protests over police brutality and racial profiling against African Americans in recent years. The U.S. president has accused his Russian counterpart of seeking to disrupt the 2022 congressional elections by spreading what he called misinformation. Joe Biden said what Vladimir Putin is doing amounts to a pure violation of the United States sovereignty. Biden called his Russian opposite number, quote, a real problem. The U.S. president said Putin is sitting on top of an economy that has nuclear weapons and nothing else. Biden underlined that Putin knows he's in real trouble, which makes him even more dangerous. This comes as Putin had already been accused of interfering in the 2016 U.S. election in favor of former President Donald Trump, a charge that Moscow denies. In Washington, hundreds have rallied outside the White House calling for an end to the U.S. blockade of Cuba, despite repeated attempts by a large contingent of right-wing Cuban expatriates to silence them. Wyatt Reed has the details.
The scorching heat wasn't enough to slow down rally organizers, the Cuban-American activists known as Puentes del Amor, or Bridges of Love, and neither was the crowd of angry counter-demonstrators. Bridges of Love marched here all the way from Miami to call on U.S. President Joe Biden to honor his campaign pledge to rescind Trump-era restrictions on Cuba.
The pilgrimage started a month ago in Miami, and we started a group of people, you know, walking from Miami through several cities, you know, Jacksonville, North Carolina, Virginia. It was a long road, and we met a lot of people along the way that support, you know, our cause, which is, you know, asking President Biden to at least minimum just sign off the sanctions that Trump put in place when it was his time.
Organizers condemned the brutal and indiscriminate economic war the U.S. has waged on the small island nation for 62 years.
I don't care who the president is, we have been the victim for far too long. So I walk with Cubans. I stand with you because since 1492, we know what oppression looks like. So we come together today to say, let Cuba live.
For some Cuban Americans, the idea of making peace with the socialist administration of Manuel Diaz-Canel is a bridge too far. They've shown up by the busload, 18 of them according to the Washington Post, to bully, harass, and intimidate those who oppose the U.S. government's seemingly endless efforts to overthrow Cuba and depose its leaders.
Not all Cubans in the United States want an intervention. Not all Cubans in the United States want a blockade. I don't know if we are majority or minority. I don't care. I know that we are at peace, that we want for our people back in Cuba to be happy and to have the right to defend by themselves within their territory. So.
Now, eventually, police erected a barrier between the groups after repeated attempts by right-wing provocateurs to disrupt the rally and intimidate its participants. In the end, activists say the event was a big success. And with President Biden recently promising that the newly announced sanctions are, quote, just the beginning, activists say we can expect to hear quite a bit more in the days to come from those who support peaceful coexistence and an end to the brutal blockade that's behind the shortages plaguing the country. Wyatt Reed, Washington.
The International Monetary Fund has warned of widening gaps between rich and poor countries due to unequal distribution of COVID-19 vaccines. The IMF has pointed to vaccine access as a major issue affecting the world recovery. The organization has cautioned that the economic recovery could be derailed if worldwide vaccination is not achieved. Global gross domestic product is predicted to grow 6% this year. According to the IMF, growth is projected to be faster in advanced economies than in that of emerging ones. To narrow the disparities, the agency has urged the advanced countries to share at least 1 billion doses to help contain the coronavirus in the developing nations. The Australian city of Sydney extends its COVID-19 lockdown for another month due to a still growing coronavirus outbreak and low vaccination rates. Authorities warn of tougher policing measures to control non-compliance. They've asked Sydney residents to report citizens breaking the rules. Sydney has been under lockdown for 5 weeks. So far, only 13% of Australians have received COVID vaccines. On Saturday, anti-lockdown protesters gathered in the cities of Sydney and Melbourne. Several people were arrested after violent clashes with police. Around half of Australia's 25 million population are now in lockdown in several cities. The number of people contracting COVID-19 in EU countries continues to rise sharply. The Delta variant of the virus, first identified in India, is the main driver of health and economic concerns in the 27-nation bloc. Jerome Humes reports.
More and more people in the EU are congregating indoors. The highly contagious Delta variant of COVID-19 is spreading like wildfire in countries like France and Spain. More people are also travelling within the EU. Citizens in Brussels have been sharing their thoughts on the Delta variant.
I don't know where the cases come from, if it's a coffee restaurant or just meeting in our house.
When I see how people are behaving sometimes, yeah, I'm not surprised.
The European Central Bank, which manages the euro, says economic confidence is being undermined.
The pandemic continues to cast a shadow, especially as the Delta variant constitutes a growing source of uncertainty.
On Monday, EU finance ministers rubber-stamped COVID-19 recovery funding for 4 additional nations in the 27-country bloc.
Croatia, Cyprus, Lithuania and Slovenia. Now more than half of national plans is adopted.
However, critics say the billions of euro being administered to national governments will result in citizens being saddled with decades more austerity because there is too much emphasis on loans rather than grants. According to analysts, EU leaders are harming the bloc's economy through their foreign policy. Sanctions are inhibiting trade. Economists say the Iranian market represents a big opportunity. It can be availed of if current efforts to save the JCPOA-Iran nuclear deal succeed. We have been speaking to the head of the European Parliament's Iran delegation about the subject via Skype. She believes the agreement will be reinstated soon.
Many people in Iran say, oh, again and again and again, we have not a good partner on this side. This is one of the impacts of this horrible, stupid policy of Trump.
The International Labour Organization, ILO, warns an additional 25 million jobs could be lost globally before the end of this year due to the coronavirus. However, the ILO says if we see an internationally coordinated policy response, the number of people losing their jobs could be much lower. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Israeli forces have fatally shot a Palestinian man in the north of the occupied West Bank. The Palestinian Health Ministry said 41-year-old Shadi Omar Lutfi Salem was shot near the town of Beit El. Local residents say there were no protests or disturbances when regime forces opened fire at the man. According to witnesses, the Palestinian man was heading home from work before getting shot. The incident comes just days after Israeli soldiers stormed the town, killing a Palestinian teenager. New clashes have erupted between Azeri and Armenian troops along their shared borders. Armenia's defense ministry says 3 soldiers were killed and 2 others were wounded in another exchange of fire last week. An Azeri soldier was killed and 3 Armenian troops were wounded. Earlier this month, a cross-border shooting also left 2 people injured. These are the latest incidents between the two neighbors since their last year war over the Nagorno-Karabakh region. Over 6,500 people were killed in the conflict that ended in November 2020 with a Russian-brokered ceasefire. Iran has carried out the test operation of its first ion therapy system. The cutting-edge technology uses protons and carbon ions to cure tough-to-treat diseases such as cancer. Our correspondent Yusuf Jalali has the details.
This equipment can cure cancer. Disambiguation. It's not treatment, but cure. The procedure is called ion therapy or particle therapy, which uses this synchrotron to accelerate protons or carbon ions to the speed of light. to kill malignant cells. The system was successfully tested in Iran's Elbors province with the attendance of the head of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, Ali Akbar Salehi, and officials from Austria's leading ion therapy center, Medastron.
There are a number of traditional methods for cancer treatment, such as surgery, chemotherapy, and radiotherapy, but what we are building here is based on ion therapy, which is now the safest method for killing tumors, and the technology behind it is possessed by a handful of countries at the moment.
Iran already uses other photon and electron-based radiation therapy techniques, but the new method will result in secondary cancers, fewer complications, and less damage to other organs.
Every year, 140,000 more people contract cancer in Iran. Some 60% of them have to go through radiotherapy sessions. Given the risks associated with the traditional radiotherapy methods, ion therapy is a viable alternative since it prevents damage to healthy tissues and only targets the DNA of the cancer cells.
Only six such facilities are operating in the world, and Iran will be the seventh to possess the technology. The project was launched in 2018 and now has made an 80% advancement, with experts from the Netherlands, Austria, and Iran cooperating to get the job done. Iran's health officials say the project will be completed in a few months. Once inaugurated, they say, the hospital will be the only ion therapy center in West Asia and will also admit patients from regional countries.
When we talk about Iran's nuclear industry, uranium enrichment is what comes in mind. But officials here say this is no longer the case, as the country has been trying to explore new realms of the subatomic world to diversify its nuclear sector. And with this new equipment, Iran has put its name on the short list of countries that employ subatomic particles to treat cancer. Yusuf Jalali from the province of Elbors.
That's a wrap for now. Bye for now, everybody.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight. The latest data from the UK Office for National Statistics shows that coronavirus in England is now largely an infection among young adults, with cases in the 16 to 24-year-old age range 6 times more common than in the 50 to 69-year-old age range. In this regard, we have prepared for you an article written jointly by Harun Siddiqui and Heather Stewart. The piece is titled, UK Doctors Warn Over Increasing Number of Young People with COVID in ICU. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. UK doctors have said increasing numbers of young people with coronavirus are being admitted to hospital, including to intensive care units, begging them not to suffer unnecessarily and to get the vaccine. Recently, after the majority of COVID restrictions were lifted in England, there were pictures of crowded coffee shops and restaurants filled with customers not wearing face masks or social distancing. Medics raised the alarm that unvaccinated young people urgently needed to protect themselves against infection to avoid serious illness. The warning came as scientists gave a cautious welcome to the fifth day in a row of falling COVID case rates, the first time that cases have seen a sustained fall without a national lockdown. However, this figure does not include the impact of 19th of July easing of restrictions. The UK recorded 29,173 new cases on Sunday, 25th of July, down from 48,161 the week before. But NHS England said one-third of 18 to 29-year-olds had still not had at least one dose of the vaccine, a figure that falls to 1 in 10 for the whole adult population. While young people are generally at a much lower risk of dying from COVID, doctors say they are increasingly witnessing them becoming severely unwell. Dr. Samantha Batroden, senior intensive care registrar, said the patients they were seeing were getting younger and younger. Dr. Samantha Batroden said the vast majority of those requiring intensive care are unvaccinated. Some of them will die. It is heartbreaking for us as NHS staff to watch people suffer unnecessarily, knowing that this almost certainly could have been prevented by the vaccine. She added, we're seeing patients in their 30s or even in their 20s who are fit and have no other medical problem in intensive care units. As an ICU doctor, I'm begging you to have the vaccine. Please don't let not having the jab become the biggest mistake of your life. Professor Adam Finn, a member of the Joint Committee on Vaccination and Immunisation and a professor at the University of Bristol, said there had been close to 200 admissions with a mean age of 40 in the city during the Delta variant wave. Speaking on LBC on Sunday, 25th of July, Professor Adam Finn said, we have had people under the age of 30 on our intensive care unit and also requiring high level of oxygen therapy. This is not always trivial in young adults. There are younger people really getting seriously ill at the moment, so that's one good reason to think about having the vaccine. He added, but the other one is, these vaccines now, it's clear, do reduce the risk of not only getting the infection, but passing it on to other people. The latest data from the UK Office for National Statistics shows that coronavirus in England is now largely an infection among young adults, with cases in the 16 to 24-year-old age range almost 6 times more common than the 50 to 69-year-old age range. Many experts had urged the government to postpone the easing of restrictions to allow more adults to get both COVID doses. On Friday, 23rd of July, Professor Robert West, a health psychologist at University College London and scientific advisor to the government, accused ministers of allowing infections to rip through the younger population in an effort to bolster levels of immunity before the NHS faces winter pressures. Dr. Adrian Boyle, Vice President of the Royal College of Emergency Medicine, said it was critical young people got vaccinated. Dr. Boyle said that whilst young people getting ill with coronavirus was rare, suddenly there's quite a lot of them just because there's so much COVID around. Saffron Cordery, the Deputy Chief Executive of NHS Providers, which represents hospital trusts, said members were reporting a much higher proportion of younger patients under the age of 40. Cordery also warned of the risk of long COVID. Government data published last month suggested more than 2 million adults in England had experienced coronavirus symptoms lasting more than 12 weeks, although the risk was found to rise with age. She said, "It is important that everyone, whatever their age, understands the risk of remaining unvaccinated." Dr. Kaveri Jalunwala, co-chair of Doctors Association of United Kingdom, a campaigning and lobbying group, also highlighted the risk of long COVID, having experienced the condition herself. She said, "Even if only 5% of people are getting long COVID, that's going to be a huge number of people having a very debilitating condition that might last for a year or even longer." She added, "It's more debilitating than people realize. People can't do their normal jobs anymore. They can't do normal activities. People struggle to walk or do any kind of exercise. We absolutely recommend everybody to get both vaccines as soon as possible, especially with the Delta variant of the virus just everywhere at the moment." The Shadow Health Secretary, Jonathan Ashworth, described levels of infection among young people as alarming. Jonathan Ashworth said, "Ministers must do more to promote vaccination, ensure young people have time off to get jabbed, and open more pop-up vaccination clinics targeting young people." The impact of COVID, and particularly the Delta variant of the virus, on young people is also of increasing concern in other countries. In the Netherlands, for example, curbs on restaurants and coffee shops were reimposed after new cases rose sevenfold. In Australia, the Nobel Prize-winning immunologist, Peter Doherty, said on Sunday, 25th of July, "Young people are at considerable risk and at higher risk than with the earlier variants of COVID. Young people shouldn't think they're at no risk or even minimal risk, because it's going to kill." The government's proposed introduction of vaccine passports has caused significant backlash among Conservative MPs, and it is unclear whether the government will be able to assemble a majority behind it. Ministers are currently considering whether to make vaccine passports mandatory for Premier League football matches and other events with more than 20,000 attendants, having already announced their introduction for coffee shops, entry and other venues where large crowds gather. Professor Finn suggested the move could backfire and a more gentle approach was needed. He said, "If people begin to feel they're being kind of forced against their will to do something, then in a sense that's quite a damaging thing to do, because it gives people the impression that vaccination is something being imposed on them from the outside." The Department of Health and Social Care spokesperson said, "We have one of the highest COVID-19 vaccine uptake rates in the world. The latest Office for National Statistics data shows 90% of adults under the age of 30 have said they would come forward for a vaccine and 3 in 5 adults aged between 18 and 24 have already received one dose of the vaccine in England. The spokesperson added, "We have worked closely with the NHS to provide information at every opportunity on how to get a vaccine and its benefits, including partnerships with high-profile celebrities, social media platforms, and dating apps to encourage uptake among the younger age groups." The spokesperson added, "We're continuing to do everything we can to boost uptake for younger people and urge all those who have yet to book their appointment to do so as quickly as possible to help protect themselves and their loved ones."
The Spotlight.
After a lapse of a year and in the absence of a full-fledged government in place, Lebanon has finally named a prime minister to form a cabinet and ward off total economic collapse. Now, this is the third nomination since the government of Hassan Diab resigned in the wake of a massive explosion in Beirut's port last August. Najib Mikati has promised transparency and reforms. There are dire shortages of pharmaceuticals, fuel, and electricity. The national currency has also lost 95% of its value. Is Mikati able to form a cabinet at last? And if so, what's the cabinet going to have to do with all the predicaments besetting the country? We'll put those issues and relevant ones in the spotlight. For an update, let's go to Mariam Salah in the Lebanese capital, Beirut, for an update on the latest there. Mariam, over to you.
Well, of course, the latest is that we had a meeting between Prime Minister-designate Mr. Najib Mikati and President, President Michel Aoun, and the Prime Minister-designate stressed that these meetings will be continuous, perhaps even on a daily basis, in order for there to be a quick formation of the cabinet, which is very necessary at this point. And what we're hearing from today from all the parliamentarians, the members of parliaments, and some of them are also previous ministers and so on, they've lived through so many cabinets, and they're stressing that the situation could not be worse than it is right now in Lebanon with the situation that you mentioned, the lack of fuel, lack of medicine, and so on and so forth, and the fact that the prices are rising hysterically. So therefore, there needs to be a stop to this economic collapse, as everyone is calling it, the worst since the 1850s, and that is something that is extremely grave and extremely critical. And this is why we see that now there's a push from all the sides to form this cabinet. There seems to be that support, that internal support. At the same time, there is a certain foreign, if we may say, push or also encouragement that you should form the cabinet and we'll give you all the assistance that you need.
Okay, thanks for that. Mariam Salah, correspondent in Lebanon. We're discussing Lebanon in this edition of The Spotlight. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi, and joining me will be author and researcher in strategic and political affairs, Ali Hamia, in Beirut. And we'll have Professor of Law and Political Science at NDU University, Eugene Sincenik, also in Beirut. Good to have you both, gentlemen. Welcome to the show. Now let's go to Ali. After months of political deadlock, Najib Mikati has been appointed as prime minister. And this as the Lebanese protesters have been demanding someone from outside of the ruling political elite whom they see responsible for bankrupting the country. Is Mikati able to form a government? And if so, could he be considered a savior for Lebanon?
First of all, it's not a coincidence to choose Prime Minister Mikati for this post at this time. Previously, he was chosen also in 2005 as a mediator and a middleman between the 8th and 14th of March parties. And since then, he served as like a heel person to the situation. This one of good points, you know, it can be marked for Mr. Mikati. And then he was appointed in 2011 also as prime minister, since, you know, after the resignation of Prime Minister Hariri. The problem is in Lebanon now, we cannot choose better than Mikati, because maybe I'm talking in the, you know, on behalf of the politician, not the people, because the people has another idea about Mikati and the whole leader in Lebanon. Prime Minister Mikati in 2011 and during his era, let's say, the vessel of death that exploded later on seaport of Beirut was at his time when it was entered. This is the first point of bad images of what we have kind of leaders in Lebanon, and among them is Mr. Mikati. Mm-hmm. The second thing is Mr. Mikati is very involved in corruption in Lebanon, and it's not only my opinion. Mm-hmm. It's like what we can see, from borrowing from banks, like about $400 million worth of debt with banks. Okay. But the best of worst now we have, the best of worst that we have in Lebanon is Mr. Mikati.
Okay.
Since we passed through an experience with Prime Minister Hariri, that he was resigned in 2019. We have Mustafa Adib after Hassan Diab, Prime Minister Hassan Diab. Most of those people are very afraid to be sanctioned by the United States. That's why it's very hard for them to form a government.
Prime Minister Mikati will face several points, if you allow me. So let me ask Eugene what he thinks about this, because protesters want somebody outside of what they call the oligarchy, and Mr. Mikati is just there. And he's been, of course, leading the country twice, like you said, as prime minister, 2005, 2011. Now, this time around, the situation seems to be much worse. Can he handle this properly this time, Eugene?
Well, that's a good question. If you want to ask about his competencies and whether he's able to do things right and effectively, I would agree with Ali Hamei. He is definitely able to do what he sets out to do. The question is, what is he going to set out to do? If you look at his home district in Tripoli, it's a mess. He and a couple of his cronies have driven this beautiful city into the ground. It has an airport, it has a harbor, it has a train station, it has an oil refinery, and a world-class fairgrounds, which are all in disrepair. This is Mikati's world. So is he going to take his skills in business, in the speculation sector, in construction and in communications, where he and his brother have made literally billions of dollars, and serve the country? If he chooses to do so, he's our man. He also enjoys, I think, the respect of all sides, including the United States. He was brought forward by Hezbollah. He has the backing of Hariri. So I think he can do it. I think he will set out and achieve whatever those goals are. Now, whether he's going to stand up to the corrupt forces in the country, he could. The situation is so dire at the moment that I think even the ruling elites are starting to get worried. Look, their children have to go to school and breathe the same air that our children breathe. And eat the same poison food and not get access. We can't, even with the fresh dollars, Lebanon's recent gift to the English language, even with the dollars coming from outside the country, you can't buy the medicines you need, even if you have the dollars. So I hope he sets out to save the country. If he does, he can do it.
Now, Ali, the Lebanese economy has been in a tailspin, horrible situation there. The currency has lost most of its value in a year. So what could Mr. Mikati's priorities be to remedy the situation?
The problem is we have experienced Mr. Mikati and the others. You know what? He was nominated by the former Prime Minister's Council. And this gives us an idea of what Mr. Mikati can do. First of all, it's very heavy situation that he cannot tolerate it. First of all, we can say if he may be accepted by all parties and by all parties in Lebanon or communities. And second of all, he has to face the economy, the disaster, and currency inflation, and the sea boundaries. And we don't have to forget that the declaration statements of the government. Could he make it? Could they form it? We know that the what we call them 8th of March parties, the golden rules, the golden statements of people, army, and resistance, and how we can that be built by him. If he can collect all those problems and solve it, this is one in one hand, but the heaviest load that he can, if he can manage it, this the seaport explosion in Beirut. Mm-hmm. I think what's going on in Lebanon now is just to pass the time in order to bypass the 4th of August, so people will not be on the street against any forming of government. Mr. Mikati, I think it's very heavy load on him. If he can do it, he must be supported by all Lebanese parties, all Lebanese people, to do so. But before he was prime minister, could he do that? He could not do anything. And we were like having so much like funds coming from everywhere. Now we are under 100 billion dollars, you know, in worst economy debt in history of Lebanon.
Right.
I don't think he can manage to do so fast. And beside that, we have also what's coming in a few months, the parliament election. Okay, can he manage to do that? Can he manage to satisfy all parties in Lebanon?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a big question first. Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Eugene, Ali mentioned the horrible situation, the dire economic situation there. So what went wrong? What made Lebanon reach this stage? And what reforms are needed?
This might sound counterintuitive, but I would say nothing went wrong, and everything went right. This is what they wanted to do. This is what they set out to do, and they achieved their goals. Lebanon has so many resources inside and outside the country. Mm-hmm. Lebanon is not Bangladesh or Haiti or something. Lebanon is a country, if they want, they can solve their weekends. I've been living here since 22 years, since 1999. We can solve our problems like that if we want to. The problem is, the bad news is, we can solve our problems like that, but we choose not to. Now, Mikati is a very competent man, so I am absolutely convinced he can deal with the issue. This was brought up, the sea border with Israel, and the issue of oil and natural gas. This is about, and this is indicative of the problem, this is about good governance. If we decide to have good governance in the oil and gas sector, we can turn this thing around. And the whole issue of foreign relations. Here again, I think he has the ties to the different players in the world if he can pull this off. The restructuring, indicative of this, is the port. Are we going to rebuild the port, or are we going to allow Haifa and the Israelis to take over the Levant and the sea lanes? Mm-hmm. The Beirut port is the key, is the gateway to the Levant. Since for the last 150 years, it was built to connect Beirut to Damascus and the hinterland. Haifa will take over if we don't do anything about it. And these deals that the Gulf states are now making with Israel, that's not going to stop. That's going to get worse. And finally, I would want to bring up the issue of asset recovery. We have, you know, we don't really know how much, but at least $20 billion in assets which were stolen from the banks, including my life savings. Mm-hmm. And we need to go out, just like any West African banana republic, and bring it back. Lebanon is a banana republic in this respect, and the foreign players are allowing them to get away with it.
Right.
I would say
right.
There's complicity on the part of the international players on this issue. So if we can get the assets that are outside the country and bring them back, and the assets that are hidden within the country, mm-hmm. we can solve the country's problems very quickly. And Makati's our man. If he chooses, he's our man.
Okay, Ali, let's look at France. France has offered this initiative based on which millions of dollars of international aid has been pledged. And the initiative is conditional, of course, on the implementation of some widespread reforms all across different aspects of government. So, but the question is, isn't Paris responsible at least partly for the current mess that Lebanon is grappling with now?
You know what? Every party in Lebanon is related to a foreign country, but in Lebanon the most important for Lebanese is France, because we call it the mother of Lebanon, or the motherland of Lebanon, whatever. Since 1991, and we were supported by France, you know, and we get so many. We were funded like so many times by Paris 1, 2, 3, CEDARS, and whatsoever. And we didn't have any plan, you know, how we're going to repay this amounts later on. The problem is, especially France, since Jacques Chirac, and then Sarkozy, Holland, and now Macron, they saw what's going on, and they still seeing what's going on, but they let what's going on just to take its long distance, if we may call it. We have so many corrupted leaders, and they still, and they are no shame. With no shame, they are doing it, they're still doing it. And most of the countries now that they are asking for us to reheal, they were involved in our corruptions.
Okay. Now, Eugene, Makati is supposed to follow on the French initiative. Is that the solution for the Lebanese issues and woes?
The French plan is good. It's a year old. They could have done this at any time. I think that the window of opportunity from January 2020 until the last year was an opportunity that was wasted. Civil society is complicit in this mess, in this disaster. Civil society was asleep at the wheel throughout the first half of last year, and they are at fault as well. I would say, as far as France is concerned, it's true. Ali Hamaei said this correctly, that we all have ties to France, to Russia, more recently the United States, Iran, Saudi Arabia. This is the normal Lebanese approach, and I think it's also the problem to always call in daddy when we have problems that we can solve ourselves. Mm-hmm. We have the resources in this country, and most importantly, if you want to look at the foreign resources, it's the Lebanese diaspora. We have so many good Lebanese who have left the country, who would love to come back and help build the country. And with COVID-19, we've seen this happening online. So the offline merge online, our OMO world, makes it even easier for us to link up with the diaspora and really introduce the one thing that will save the country, which is rule of law. And that's all we need. We need to respect the rules and apply them, because when Lebanese go abroad, they're really good. The problem is the culture of impunity within this country, and Makati has a choice. I mean, he can either continue to go along this road and lead us to the ultimate disaster, or he can turn it around, and he can turn it around very easily with the resources we have.
Okay. Ali, we'll talk about France now. Let's...
...are corrupted. I think the system is corrupted. The whole system needs to be changed. Mm-hmm. You know, because most of people, corrupted people in Lebanon, and the corruptions and the misleadings were like under the law, not above the law. So legally, they did all the corruptions in Lebanon.
Okay, Ali, also, I want to ask about the U.S. Where is the U.S. in this?
United States, usually, you know, the most important for the United States in the region is the security of the Zionist entity. And what's the most important for the U.S. is to save the sea boundaries with Lebanon now. Okay, and if we may say and remember that on the 17th and before the 17th of October 2019, some big American politician came to Lebanon and he said, either, you know, we solve the Lebanese boundary or starvation. Lebanon will go into starvation, and that's what we are going through now. They didn't say we will be a poor country. They didn't say that we will be only like corrupted country. They say we will be starved. And that's what we are passing by. We are not allowed to import like oil from Iran or Iraq. We are not allowed to deal with Syria. Of course, we have on the southern boundary, we have our enemy. So we are totally seized by United States. Mm-hmm. And what's, you know, amazed me that some people in Lebanon will accuse the resistance in Lebanon by having people going so down and in need. We can blame only, by my opinion, we can only blame who put us into sanction and seized the country, the whole country, from all around borders, okay, from all sides.
Now, Eugene, isn't it high time that this traditional sectarian consensus system of governance be abolished?
Oh, that's that is the question. First of all, I just want to say, Ali, I agree the system is corrupt, but I would disagree. The system is not corrupt. It is corruption. Corruption is systemic. Corruption is the system. Mm-hmm. So it's so ingrained in the culture. And the sea borders, I just want to mention that in passing, but I'll get back to that. Corruption is closely linked to sectarianism, not confessionalism. Lebanon is a very diverse country, and each group needs its respective representation. Confessionalism is a good thing. Sectarianism is the abuse of difference. And this is a system that does not have to be. There were many, many periods in Lebanese history where the differences led to coexistence. Mm-hmm. So we can go back to that. There are people who thrive on abusing differences within the country, whether they're language or religion or skin color. We know different countries have different types of diversity. I know that Iran has a very interesting model for diversity, relatively well respected around the world. So I would say that diversity is not the problem. It's the abuse of diversity to cause fights within the groups and to feed on corruption. Just the issue of the sea borders, I think that's actually an issue for hope as well. No matter who you are in Lebanon, you have a certain grudging respect for Hezbollah. What they did in 2006 was amazing. I mean, we all know that. So the Israelis are willing to negotiate because of the resistance and the sea border. They have to. Oil and gas investments, especially gas investments are long-term. So they have to, if they're going to go forward with their plans for the Arab Gulf, and that's the American game plan now, it's okay, Israel and the Gulf, they have to have peace of some sort with Lebanon. So I would say the resistance is actually a good thing in our international relations with the U.S.
Okay, unfortunately we're out of time. Thank you very much, gentlemen. Author, researcher in strategic and political affairs, Ali Hamia, joined us from Beirut, and also from Beirut, professor of law and political science with NDU University, Eugene Senek. I've been your host, Behrouz Nejat.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Thank you.
log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Life and personality of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Month of Wilaya from IRIB English Radio. Sayyid Ali Al Musavi Al Jazairi.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Allahumma salla ala Muhammadin wa alihi at-tahirin. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Dear brothers and sisters, I hope that you are doing well and you are keeping well. أنا وعلي أبا وهذه الأمة. Ali and I are the parents of this nation, the Holy Messenger of God said. In our previous programs, we tried to discover the secret behind the position of the divine authority and wilayah, and we mentioned the two fundamental elements of love and knowledge as this secret. The very elements that causes the father and mother, the parents, to deserve the position and right of the authority and wilayah over their children. The first and the most manifest instance of the knowledge and love is the infinite existence of God Himself. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is the source of all knowledge and love. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is the creator of knowledge and love. As you remember, brothers and